The following is an unrehearsed interview with Mrs. Pauline Willis Welch by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at Mrs. Welch's home in Middlesboro, Kentucky on June 27, 1978 at 10:30 a.m. The first thing I want to start with, Mrs. Welch, is just some personal background. Now, just give me your full name.
You mean where I was born?
Now, what's your full name first?
Well, my maiden name and all, Pauline. My real name's Paulina, but everybody just calls me Pauline. Willis Welch.
Where were you born?
I was born in Claiborne County, what they called the post office that time was Providence, or Old Town, either one. My grandfather had the post office that time, and I was born on his farm in the house that belonged to my grandfather, June 3rd, 1899.
Who were you married to?
My husband's name was Charles Welch. He was born in Claiborne County, too.
Now that's Claiborne County, Tennessee, isn't that correct? Claiborne County, Tennessee?
Yes, yeah, just over the state line here, you know.
From Middlesboro.
Nevada. And he's been dead about 10 years now. But he had always worked in or around the mines. So we moved. Part of the time we lived in the mines, and part of the time, most of the time, Middlesboro, went to school in Middlesboro. But during my younger life, I lived out west for a short few years. And then when we came back, we live mostly in Middlesboro. It seemed like that's my real home because I've spent most of my life here. But I've seen great changes in the mining. Most of them are strip mines now, you know. When we lived, they'd always have these big camps. Well, kind of like the song you've heard Tennessee Ernest sing about 16 ton. Well, that described it a whole lot. But I think one of the nicest places I ever lived was Clear Fork Coal Company at Pondy, because the owners and managers were all good Christian people, and they had such a nice, good place to raise your children and kept good schools. They demanded good teachers for their schools. And I really think it was a nice place to raise your children, unlike most of, more like a little town with the Christian men at the head of it.
Now, where was this at? Fondy?
That's over the mountain, Fondy, Kentucky.
Oh, Fondy, Kentucky, okay.
Just over the mountain from Millsburg. Over, the mountain's named Fondy, too. It's a terrible road now, but it had a good road to it then. And I worked there in the commissary for the coal company for almost 2 years. And they were they're just good Christian people. And they didn't have all that rough stuff like they had in Harlan County.
Was it just established to be a coal camp? I mean,
coal mining.
The company owned everything?
That's what they did. They had about three different openings there that they got coal from. It's a big company.
What company was it?
It was Clear Fork Coal and Coke Company. Mr. Tampkin opened up the mines for the, it belonged to the American Association, you see. That was headed by Englishmen. Their headquarters now is still in London. But at that time, the American Association owned the land, and they opened these mines. Mr. Tampkin did. Now, he was the father-in-law of the man that managed it, was president of it when I was working over there. He was dead then, Mr. Tampkin. But Mr. Reams, father of the ones got the hardware store. He was such a fine Christian man.
Well, now, is this mine closed now?
Yes. Now, I don't know where they've got any of, I imagine some of the land's been strip mined. They've ruined our beautiful mountains. I wish that had never been let start. They've ruined the property of the people that owns it off the association land, and they've just always just... Now, this flood that we had last year is bad. all that silt and everything because of strip mining all over the county and all, and that's the reason Pymal had such a time, you know. I think strip mining's the worst thing ever happened in this country. I really do. And I'll tell you what I find fault with it. They don't work as many men as they did with the drift mouths, you know, the internal mines. And by them not a doing that, the man in charge of it makes such a big profit. And really, it don't much of it go back into the communities because it's not spread out over a general big large number of employees. They just don't need as many men with a strip mine. They just shovel up that dirt, you see, and uncover the coal and load that. Of course, it's not pretty clean coal like you used to have. I think it's the worst thing that ever happened to this country. Then that silt, if comes a big heavy rain or a little cloud burst on one of the mountains, all that silt washes down into the mountain streams, brings it right on down into the valleys, and that's what causes many of our floods. Such a waste.
When did the mine close at Fondy?
Well, now, let's see, how long's that been? I don't believe I could remember it to exact date. I know my husband worked there for years and years. When did it close, Alva? What'd she say?
1959.
Well, she lives there. She lives over there.
Oh, there are still people there?
There's still one of the houses. She lives there and comes over every morning. Middlesbrough, just about it.
Well, now, is it in Bell County?
Yeah. It's in Bell County, isn't it, Ella? Yeah, it's a home product.
Well, what's it like now?
Well, just a lot of houses. People still living. They've got interest there. They've got a post office yet and a small general store. About 12 families live there, don't they?
Oh, I guess 20 families live there, maybe.
20, she said.
I imagine.
Yes, she
20.
Lives there. She can tell you about that.
There's at least 20.
It's one of the nicest coal camps I've ever known. Isn't that right?
25 families still live there. We have 2 little churches.
They still have a church?
Got 2 churches still going. Don't have any school. They moved our school.
When they worked 500 men, they even rode from Jellicoe and all up and down the mountains. And it was a big mine, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They worked about 500 or 600 people.
They worked about 600.
Yeah.
At one time, there was about 1,500 people there.
Yeah. And it was a nice place to raise your children, wasn't it? Her father was one of the bosses there at Pawnee Coal Company.
Still a good place to live, but, you know, just...
That's where Middlesbrough got its bloodstream, was from the coal mines when it was first settled and all. The coal operators' children weren't allowed to play with the miners' children, you know. They'd come down here to school, and they wouldn't care if they had a good school or not in the camp, you know, but it wasn't that way at Pawnee. They had a good school, they kept good school for the children, they kept good things in their commissary, and I don't think they was unreasonable in the prices like they were in a lot of commissaries. Of course, it's high enough.
They come out from Fundy into all walks of life. Doctors, school teachers, missionaries, nurses, officers in the Army and Marine, and all in the service. And just, you know, preachers and anything, lawyers, doctors.
Mr. Langford kept a notice of every child, every boy, or girl either, that when it left its school over there, what became of them. And we had a higher ratio of college graduates and professional people come out of that mining camp of any town of its size in the state of Kentucky, because he kept it. Yeah. So many of them went into service and won medals and all. Some of them made doctors. 2 of the bookkeeper's sons are both doctors. One of his sons, the biggest heart doctor, is in Louisville. And everybody comes there. It's Dr. Charles Smith. And one of them went to Texas. He's a doctor out there. They've made druggists, they've made doctors, they've made dentists, they've made just about all of them have turned out, you know, pretty well. I think a good background to a child's important, don't you?
Yeah.
The surroundings and all. But they did. They had a good school for children. I know when we moved over, back over here, so I could work as a social worker in Tennessee, you know. That's how I come to move back to Nevada for a little while. Well, I had experience and they offered me a job if I'd move back. So when we moved back, that one near as good school as we had at Fondy. They said, well, coming out of a coal camp, said, I imagine Jimmy, that's my youngest boy, will be behind in some of the subjects. Said, but we'll help him catch up, the professor told me. He's taught me about 3 weeks. I was waiting on the bus, and he told me. He said, you know, he already had about everything we're going to have this year. Said he could really go in a higher grade. I said, no, don't want him to skip a grade. And he went, and when he graduated from the high school over in the valley, he won 7 medals, every medals but one, he won it. And he's the only one in all that first class at the academy that had 2 appointments. In other words, a Republican senator appointed him and a Democrat senator. Mr. Reese appointed him as Republican, and Senator Kefauver appointed him as a Democrat. And because of his high grades, you know.
That was when he
made straight A's.
Air Force Academy?
Yeah, that's when he graduated in high school.
Uh-huh.
That's how he got
in.
Yeah, because
okay.
A lot of them, you see, had already had a year or two. His roommate had 2 years at UCLA, and Jimmy had to help him with his grammar. He hadn't had basic grammar, but he helped Jimmy with calculus because we didn't have higher math, you know, down in Powder Valley. And Jimmy made about middle of the student list, which was fine with the Iowa Country High School.
I want to go back now, Mrs. Welch, and talk about this area before 1900. Now, I understand that your mother has told you some stories and your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
So you have
we lived till I was 6 years old in La Follette, and the town was named after the founder. Was some relation, distant relation of the La Follettes. It was in Washington, you know, central La Follette. They had large coke ovens there, but my father was boss at one of the ore mines. That's what he did when we lived there. And we had, I can remember the first automobile I ever saw was after we went to Texas, but one came up the valley from La Follette in 1905. As the first car that ever came to La Follette was 1905. And when we went west, went to my uncle's ranch in the Panhandle of Texas, because he wanted to come back here and spend a year or two back here. And my daddy went and run the ranch for him the year he came back here. And that's the reason we roamed around so much. We still homesick for the mountains. That's the reason we came back. We got into Herman about 4 o'clock after being gone 8 years. And my mother woke every one of us children up so we could look out and see the mountains. We couldn't remember. My older brother and sister could, but younger children couldn't remember, you know, the mountains. Never remembered them. And we stayed here. Grandma was the 6th reason we came back. And she died that summer. So we just came on back to Middlesbrough, our old stamping ground. And we've been here ever since. Oh, I've lived at the camp out of the town, but still in the county, you know, and across the state line and all, but done all my shopping and went to school here in Middlesbrough. And I wouldn't trade for any town I know. It's a pretty nice town, but I like my church. We have good schools, and what more if you're raising children? That's just about all you're looking for anyway. good environment.
What types of stories did your mother tell you about people, or your grandmother or anyone, tell you about people coming through the gap?
Oh, yeah. Well, now, she'd tell me about when the tunnel was built, because a group of young people rode in the tunnel horseback. Of course, she rode side saddle. All the young ladies did then. Her horse fell down, and she was hurt a little bit, but not seriously. And that was at the time when the Four Seasons Hotel was flourishing at Harrogate, you know. We'd have society people from up north, from all over the country, you know, to come down during that time. But after LMU as a university was founded, why, of course, so much of that quit. It was a more of a educational institution then, you know, and people was interested in that. But now the people that came down through this country at that time was interested more and getting a place where they get the children educated, or the coal mines. That Millsburg was really founded as a coal town. Now that was really the Englishman that founded it, opened up all the big old coal companies. Used to be, they'd run two trains a day out of each holler. And the kids that come down to go to school in Millsburg, operator's children, the boss's children, of course the others had to go to school in the camp. But as for being lawless, it used to be pretty rough because there were saloons here, you know, and on Saturday there's a great deal of drinking, and I know they wouldn't let us go to picture show by ourselves on Saturday because it's always whiskey and stuff, you know, and always just one thing to do. Some of the older people would go with us, but otherwise it was pretty quiet town. After whiskey went out, well, it was a better town. You know that. Of course, we got it now, but you don't see it so much.
Is Bell County a wet or dry county now? You've mentioned.
Well, I know Middlesbrough's dry, because last preacher we had worked so hard, bootleggers not forgiving him yet. But we don't have too much bootlegging here. We've got a good police force. But you're going to have some of it. I don't care what you have. But we've got a good police force, good mayor. And we've got one of the best Salvation Army leaders and his wife that we've ever had since I've been in Millsburg. And I can remember going to town when the saloons was running wide open here. And you get accustomed to seeing drunk people, which a child shouldn't have to do. But they didn't turn them loose with a hot rod then, like we have our young people now, because when you cross Cumberland Avenue, you take your life in your hands. But we, on the whole, I think we have pretty good law control. And now, in those days, a man works so hard in the mines, I guess he had to have some kind of opening or something, you know, to kind of lay off steam to build up during his work. But coal miners have gotten so many benefits through being organized, so I think they've been organized out of a whole lot of the things they ought to have. In other words, they've just been unreasonable in some of their demands. But going back to the days, now I can remember when it wasn't that way. I remember a man most time had to leave a company if they found out he joined the union. I knew that my husband had a brother-in-law that had to leave the place he lived in for years because he joined the union. And, well, we've got too much union now. But men have to have it. There's no use in talking now. They've never been recognized, and they had to have a union before they could even have their teller. They just weren't treated right. Now, that's the truth. I remember back when my children were babies, they had what they call the cleanup system. And a man had to clean his place up before he left that day, the coal miner did. And then he never saw daylight. He'd go in mines before daylight, and he'd be after dark when he'd come out, those long hours. Well, the union did away with that. And I didn't live in Harlan, but I lived close enough to it. I know the men were just like slaves. And they had to have a union. They'd no use in talking. I don't believe in some of the demands that makes a little unreasonable. I don't think much of the president they've got now to tell you the fact about it. They need John L. Lewis against what they need.
Well, was there a great deal of violence in getting the union?
Huh?
Did it take a lot of violence to get the union established?
Well, yes, it did. Oh, yeah, when we lived up in the holler, the mines were shut down where we lived. And I'd have to come out and go over to Tassel to work, you know. We were stopped by this little old hot shot deputy and demanded to search a car. Why, it was an affront to us because my husband never been in any trouble, any violence, anything. He never had had any trouble with the company. And he told him, he said, well, what would you look for in my car? He said, well, I want to see if you got any guns. He said, well, I don't even have a gun in my home. And we just come on then. But now they asked for all that shooting they had up there. And I was working in Tavis at the time up when that president of the American Association was shot down. Little hot-headed deputy sheriff from Claiborne County is one that killed him. Killed him and the manager of Porkeridge on their own side because he just, you know, hot-headed. He'd come a big bunch of them down from Harlan. They'd hit on the side of the road up here above Yellow Creek by the stumps and the rocks. And the first shot was fired by that old deputy from Claiborne County, old Tazewell. And he killed a bookkeeper of the big coal company on the his side, in other words. And but I was working, and a week or two before that, the president of the American Association had mocked a medical thing out of Claiborne County. He was a magistrate. He didn't live in Claiborne, didn't live in Bell County. I mean, he didn't live in Claiborne County. He lived over here at Bell County, but he was one of the squires from the county over in Tennessee. How he did it, I don't know. But he voted that medical help to Claiborne County for the doctor come from Knoxville and give the little tubercular children shots. And I know the lady that I worked with said, Miss Welch, there's something bad going to happen to that man. Said, when you go to mistreating God's little people, said, there's something bad. God don't let it go on. Honey, it wasn't a month till that man was shot and killed. And she reminded me up the next morning. I come over there and said, you hear about that awful thing happened last night? I said, yes. Lady's neighbor rode by and told me about it, and she said, I told you last month, didn't I? They were lined up by those little tubercular children get their shots that morning and wasn't no medicine for them because Mr. Rhodes, he became angry at something that didn't go his way in county court. He didn't even live. He lived here in Middlesbrough. So you can see how close Claiborne County and Bell County is to each other by their property and their cases. But, honey, we had plenty of violence. And there'll still be violence. Now, Charlie worked in Harlan the last several years of his life. And things kind of peaceful up there then, you know. But I don't know. That's the battle at Everett's where so many people's killed. But they sure hate the Union up there. Operators do.
Well, what were some of the demands that the early coal miners made?
Huh?
What were some of the demands of the early coal miners? What did they want from them?
Oh, you mean before they got a union?
Uh-huh. What did
they wanted shorter hours, and they wanted, well, now the first thing they got was a raise in prices. And then it's not what you make a day, it's how many days work you get. And the mines never run 12 months a year, you know. It's always times they couldn't sell their coal. And I guess the first raise it did most good was on the Roosevelt. I can remember that because I hadn't had a raise in several years. But I think this last settlement, I think it's just too much because it keeps the other prices, it causes too much inflation, but still they have to have it to, in other words, the inflation come first and we've got to do something before we can do away with it. And I'm not smart enough to tell them how to get rid of inflation. I wish I was. I'd have to come from Georgia before I'd get a job doing that.
Well,
I'll tell you, the men have to have a union. There's no doubt about it. And they ought to be careful who to put in as leaders. They ought to put in, now I know that Fondy, they put a mine committee on sometime to talk to the manager and all and the superintendent. And he wouldn't have education enough to sign his own name to a piece of paper. They ought to try to get good leaders that was reasonable man to talk to, but they didn't do that all the time. Neither side did. Most of them was hotheads. But I think Fondy had less trouble than anybody, although they had some shooting over there once possible we ever lived there. But her daddy, I guess, knowed all about that. I was just telling her about, they had shooting and some, didn't they have troops over there one time at Fondy?
At one time.
Huh?
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
They broke the strike in
but now, Elder, your father was a foreman there.
Yeah.
But now they had to have a union, the men did,
oh,
didn't
yeah.
they? Now they just had to have it. There wasn't no use in talking.
Yeah, they worked, they loaded coal for 10 and 20 cents a ton before they got the union. And worked for, from sun up till sun down.
Now I know
and
some companies
that... $1.50 or $2 a day or
they couldn't hardly make more than $2 a day to save their life before the unionized,
no,
could be. Their children didn't have, but they just couldn't afford to buy a milk part of them. They had to have, the union was forced on them. And Alan, who was superintendent at the time they had that violence there? Was it Kivett?
Well,
see, I didn't live there then.
Well, I didn't either, but I've heard people talk about
when that happened, yeah. You just well give your job up there, found out, but I'll tell you one thing.
Well, now, Mr. Langford was there, and I don't know who
he was. He was a fine man, though. He told me one day, he said, how can I talk to a man? He showed me this man didn't have sense of going to the store and buy what he wanted. He said, how can I sit down and talk to that man and reason with him? I said, I can't even find out what he wants in the story. He couldn't understand nothing he said hardly. There's two sides to the story. And it looks like the intelligent, educated, good people could get together without having trouble. I just don't see. I don't think much president they've got, I'll just tell you the fact, because when they cut out all the medical bills and everything this last year, he got sick, but he didn't. He got his medical bills paid. Well, he ought to get anything the men don't get. I feel awful sorry for the ones that got in that trouble and's in prison because that was the way they had to establish it. But two wrongs never made a right, and I certainly don't condone killing anybody because if you did that, you ought to be punished for it, no matter who you are.
Let's move on now and talk about your Mother's Day now, or grandmother, either one. When they set up housekeeping in the early days, what was it like?
Well, she still had some things she set up housekeeping with, but my grandfather had to get, he made his, most of his money with, in merchandise store, he had a general store. And raising stock, which he shipped on a raft down the river from Knoxville to Chattanooga. But he was a man that his word was his bond, and he'd extend credit to his neighbors and the people in the community just as long as he cared, because he said he found nearly everybody he dealt with were honest, good people. He had very few people that would be about anything. And he'd, as I told you, well, he accumulated enough money to get his start. He worked for as low as 25 cents a day of plowing, hanging his pants up in an apple tree, because he only got two woven pair of pants a year for the speed. They spun, they raised flax and spun their own linen. And they had a few sheep that they would use for the wool for comforts and things. But during the war, grandmas told me how they buried their stuff in the cellar and take their stock out in the deep woods where they couldn't hear the mules bray or the cows moo when the armies had come marching through.
The Civil War.
Yeah. They'd march up and down the valley and take every bit of food they could find. That during the Civil War, you know. And I wish Mama was alive. She could sure tell you. But now Grandma was young. Mama was born. Grandma's family was young. But now her first husband died during the Civil War, because he was a prisoner in a Union camp when she went to see him. And he finally died in the camp, and she lost her baby coming back, her little baby that was born, because she just had to travel a few days as she'd get away to go to see him before he died. When she came back, my grandfather was already established over there, and his wife had died, leaving him with five little children. He married Grandma because she didn't have any children. He didn't think two sets of children would grow up together. And Grandma said the day she came in, he said, "Now, children, this is your new mother, and you call her mother." And Grandmother said, "No, y'all, I'm not their mother, and they know I'm not their mother." Said, "Children, my name's Nancy, and you all call me Nancy. To if you learn to love me enough and want to call me mother, I'll be glad for you to do that. But said, my name's Nancy. You just call me Nancy till you want to accept me as your mother." And everyone was just crazy about her. She's so good to them, you know. And Grandpa, he had one fault. He loved money. Grandma used to tell him he could see a $5 bill a mile away.
Excuse me.
He never would turn anybody away if they had a child. You know, they walked there before they went in those days. He'd say, "Nancy, I can't see. Do they have a little child with them?" And if they did, they'd keep them all night, you know. But if they didn't have any, he'd say, "Go to the bar and sleep."
Excuse me, I'm going to turn the tape over. This is side two of an interview with Mrs. Pauline Welch. Now go ahead, Mrs. Welch. You were telling about your grandparents. Just go ahead and talk about their, what you were saying about your grandfather.
You know, I barely can remember him. I was over 3 years old, but still, I just can remember. He was very strict. He was a deacon in the church. He wouldn't let my mother and her brothers and sisters go to dances. He thought that was terrible. But they step out and go and tell him that they just gonna play games like skip to Maloo and shoot the buffalo. Of course, they're dance games, you know. And he never did know that the dances, he thought they were just playing games at the dances, you know. He didn't like for me to go to them. He was a very religious man. When he married, by his ceremony was very short, very few words. And then he'd say, "Now, John, your right hands, I pronounce you man and wife." And I guess that held him just as tight if he'd had a long ceremony, don't you guess?
Long as it was legal.
Yeah.
What else did they do for entertainment?
Well, outside of their, most of them was in their community, you know. Of course, they had their church revivals. It's big time when they'd have a revival, you know. And some of the old Baptist preachers very narrow-minded. I think they're very liberal today. And I don't guess that question of gays ever come up in their church. But I know that they had some funny times. Mama said they'd always get ready for a lot of company during a revival. And when my uncle married kind of young, and the families both tried to outdo each other with the dinners they gave, you know. And the colored people that lived on the farm that did the work, they had a big argument driving the bride and the groom up from her home to my grandmother's for their big meal that evening. Said, "You know," said, "our lady, Miss Nancy," said, "she had the best dinner." Said, "You won't get that kind of meal tonight." They always called it dinner and supper. And the colored man is driving the buggy that was belonged to my grandfather. Said, "You don't know our Miss Nancy." They's both named mother-in-law named Nancy. Said, "Well, she's even got a bunch of weeds on the table." He'd never seen any celery, and he thought it was weeds, and he thought because grandmother had celery that it beat the oven. And said, "We don't even drink our coffee till after the meal's over." So they had their places of entertainment just like we have now, you know. My grandfather always kept a little real good liquor up in the top of the cupboard in the dining room, kind of a buffet. But he lived to see his son, one of them, made one of the best lawyers that Claiborne County ever had. And he wouldn't drink until he'd get off of a case and then he'd get drunk. He was a brilliant man, and grandfather couldn't stand to see that. He took that bottle down and said, "There'll be no more medicine in this house. It needs like that." And he broke it, and there would have any more in the house. After he saw his son would get drunk once in a while. Finally, somebody poisoned him after he won this big case at Tasbourne. They put some croton oil in some liquor he drank, and it killed him. He died in 3 days. He was a brilliant man. It's a shame, but he asked for it, I guess. And then he had another son that went to down at Jacksboro. Was in, another name and put a store up, and he became a merchant. He had another son. Let's see, now what did he do? Two of them, I think, made lawyers. One of them couldn't already make a living. But they all turned out pretty well. My mother's oldest half-sister went to Missouri and raised her family after she became a woman. And I was a little girl. Oh, I wasn't so little. I was up in my teens. A strange lady came here in Middlesbrough to our door one day and said, "Does Miss Willis live here?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "I want to see her, please." Of course, I never had seen her, I didn't think. So I went to get my mother. She's in the dining room, and she came to the door. She knew her immediately. She hadn't seen her for over 40 years. It was her older half-sister, you know, and she'd married and gone to, at the close of the war, she'd gone to Missouri to live. And the others were dead. She didn't get to see them. She'd been out there so long. Travel was quite different than it is now. You know, it took days and days and days to go across the country. But Grandpa, as I said, lived by his word was his bond, and he thought that everybody ought to do just what they should do. And he lost quite a bit of money sometimes by trusting people that not around him. They were honorable people. But, you know, in deals that he'd make with people, I know one stock man beat him out a little money and things like that. But on the whole, most people are honest. You don't find too many dishonest people. But I still had his coat for a long time. Finally got did away with it that he used to wear when he'd go to court. He always put on these coats pleated in the back with two buttons back there, you know, squire coat. But he was a fine old man.
You mentioned the slave.
And my grandmother was a little woman, so pretty. She's that don't do her justice. She's prettier than that. But she died when she was 75. Now people live a lot longer than that. I'm stronger than she was a long time before she died. Everybody had a, they raised all their, that's one thing about the inflation. Grandmother raised practically and did practically everything they ate, and more was produced on their place, you know. And they just don't do that anymore. They go to the store for their old margarine and their butter and their milk and their bread. And my mother always baked all of our bread once a week, and that did us that week, and then she'd bake again on Friday, you know. And I think that's one thing that's caused inflation. We depend on the other people for everything we get to eat and wear and everything. I've lived beyond my day, I think.
Well, now, you mentioned raising all your food. How did they preserve all their foods?
Well, Grandma even preserved herbs and things. She's a pretty good doctor. They had to. They didn't have anybody to go to, you know. And Mother used a lot of those simple home remedies. They was years and years. They wouldn't be a doctor in our house. Mama knew what was good for a swollen abscess tooth. She knew what to do when you had a temperature. She knew these little simple things, you know, that we don't know anymore. But Grandma would gather her yarbs, they call them then. You know, Grandma had pretty good education. She knew better to talk like that. But most people call herbs yarbs. That's what they call them. I don't know why. But she'd dry her things that she needed, gather them in the fall to make her teas and her brews out of, you know, and simple things. And then she would dry all of her apples. She would, she had a thing they made for her where she could preserve her peaches outside the canning part, you know. Well, Grandma thought she'd fail in her garden if she didn't have beans for the first Sunday in June. I think the seasons changed a lot of it, but now they raised practically everything they ate. They even kept guineas, turkeys, sheep. They kill a lamb every spring, and then they'd kill about a half-grown beef for their veal, you know, and stuff. And he always killed 12, 14 hogs, and they wouldn't fool with livers and things. Maybe they'd cook a mess, but they gave it to the colored people that did their butchering for them, lived on the place. And Grandpa peeled a smokehouse full of good meat, you know, and everything. Grandma made her own soap. And, well, they had a big cellar in their home. They built a new home when Mom was 10 years old, had a great big rock cellar in a cave underneath the house. And Grandma kept a lot of stuff down there. They raised all their potatoes. They'd hold their apples up. They had the fresh apples all winter. They would dig a hole in the orchard and cover them with leaves and straw and put the boards up just like in Fox Bar. Now that tells you know how to do that. That's a way of life with them. They had one thing they did, they had plenty to eat. Grandma was a good cook and they always set a good table. But I think people are so wasteful nowadays. We waste enough food in America to feed the whole world. I know we waste bread because we won't eat old bread. And it hurts me for that food, knowing that there might be somebody hungry, you know. But how are you going to get it to them?
You mentioned making your own clothes. Now, did all the girls just learn to sew, or did you hire somebody to do your sewing, or how did they do this?
Well, Grandma always got a woman to come stay from a week to 2 weeks to do their family sewing for a year. They made the man's underwear, you know. Man, you couldn't step out and buy a ready-made man's underwear at all. And they'd wear 3 and 4 petticoats, the girls would, you know, when they was dressed up, their skirts was full, and Mama had a brass fluting iron, and after they'd iron their petticoats, they'd flute the ruffles and flounces on those petticoats so their dresses would stand out. Washing was an all-day dealing with the colored women on the place usually did the washing. And they, two of them would wash all day long down at the spring and boil everything, you know, the white, to want to keep it real white. Then on the ironing day, well, the girls would have to help out with that. Two or three of them would iron all day, heat the iron by the open fireplace back of the stove so Grandma wouldn't be in the way of her cooking. Well, then Grandpa kept a great big amount of bees hive. They had a large can of honey. Grandma would put up her whole cellar shelves full of blackberries and cherries and stuff, you know, and apple butter and stuff like that. They put up about everything they ate all winter. But now when we went out in Texas, they dried their corn. You know, the wind's so hot and blows so much out there. They'd cut off little roast ears, shave them off in little fire, and dry that, and they sold that in storage. Did you ever eat any dried roast ears?
No.
Mama'd soak it all night. It's pretty good. And different parts of the country, they preserve their food in different ways, you see. But I think Grandma and Grandpa had the best way of life. I think we've lost something by modern times. When I was a girl in school, my teacher would say, well, we couldn't tell much about the moon. We never know much about it. She guessed it was over 90,000 miles away. You know how far away the moon is. So I guess what we didn't know in those days didn't hurt us.
Well, you mentioned the colored people. Now, your family had slaves. Is this...
Huh. They weren't slaves. See, they were free then. Oh. After they freed the Civil War, but they'd been raised, and they'd been born on the place, and then they'd marry somebody, and then they'd build them a little cabin. They was three families that lived on my grandfather's place, and their in-laws and children would live with them. And they would take... they didn't pay them so much as they just kept them something to eat and buy them clothes when they needed it because they didn't have steady work for them, but they didn't let any of them suffer. That's forced many of them scattered out and worked, you know, up north and around, but that's in the days that the people had to take care of their own people around them that was needing help. And it was three generations, I know, raised out of my grandfather's place. And after we moved to Middlesbrough, I was 14 years old. And one of the women that was Mama's age that my mother had taught to read and write, see, they wouldn't let them go to a white school, but she taught this woman to read and write when she was a little girl and in school. And this woman had appreciated it because she could sign her name, read out of the book, you know, and all. She come to see my mother one day. They always came around the back door. No, they wouldn't come in the front door. And I saw my mother give her a little money when she left, and give her dinner and some other things. And that's the way they'd always been used to doing, you see. And that woman's granddaughter lives here in town now and got plenty. Her, you know, she gets, in other words, she draws like everybody. Everybody gets a check while they draw, you know. So I guess those days, that's the only way they could take care of the ones that had been freed, because they had nowhere to go. And Grandpa, as I said, he killed that many hogs. They would take the lights, the kidneys, the heart, the liver, and they'd cook them, and they'd cover them with some kind of grease that they'd cook, you know, from the hog. And then they'd cover that while it's cooked, and cover that, put straw on top, and scoot back on the bed. The colored people, as I've seen them pull out a pot many days and undo that and get them out enough for their dinner, you know. That's the way they preserved it. Grandma used to preserve sausage by making bags about this big around, long ones, out of domestic. She make two thicknesses, and she dipped that in boiling lard, and let that, after she stuffed it with sausage, she stuffed that with sausage about this big around, and tied up at the end, she'd make them about this long, and she'd lay that down in boiling lard that she'd render out, and let it lay for so long. And that was cooked enough, just hanged up in the smokehouse. When she get ready to cook that, she'd slice that bag and all right across and unwind it and fry that meat, and it was delicious. They knew how to preserve things. But I don't know. I'd hate to depend on that now. I still like to make my own jellies and jams and can my beans and things. It just tastes better than what you buy.
What kind of furniture did they have in their early
Grandma
homes?
Grandma had pretty furniture. Grandpa would go to Knoxville and get it. Let's see, do I have anything? I've got to step there in my room and look at that high chair with that buffet. That's my mother's chair that he had made for her when she was 10 months old. And I've got it. It's a nice thing to make. Take to the sawmill and season it. And they made a lot of the furniture by hand. But their bulk furniture, Grandpa would get it when he'd ship a load of stock down there. He'd go to Knoxville. He brought my aunt back a little baby buggy with a little doll that pushed along. She'd wind up. And they came from miles and miles and miles around to see that contraption that Mr. Carr bought at Knoxville. They never seen anything mechanical like that. That's been over 100 years ago. They didn't have plastic then, you know. So he always brought the family something. Grandma had some beautiful pictures he'd bought down there from an art gallery. He'd always bring the family get them something pretty every time he'd ship a load of stock. He liked pretty things, Grandpa did. And they drank out of a gourd. That gourd had to be scrubbed about twice a week with sand. It was just as white, a dried gourd. That's what they drank out of. Kept one down the spring house. I'd hate to keep one drink after everybody went chew. Lord, Grandma scoured that. She had scoured. Twice a week that had to be scoured. And they had a room up there that they used for the drummers and all, when they'd have to put up, you know, with them. And it was done in that white-colored maple furniture. My sister still got that automatic rocker they had on springs, you know, one busy Corbin. And what we call the help room upstairs, for the help would stay, they had straw ticks. And they'd take those ticks, the covers off of them once a year, and boil them and wash them, and then they'd fill them with good clean straw when the wheat was threshed, and they'd put that back on the beds. And I don't see how they got time to do all that, but they didn't have, they had more time spare than I have. I was pretty good managers, I guess, about time, don't you guess? And every washstand had a bowl and a pitcher and a brush holder and a soap dish. Every room had that washstand with that. And when you had company, that water, the pitchers was filled with hot water and cold water. And they did their touches to their toilet from that to there. They didn't have bathrooms like we have, you know. But every room had its own water and its washstand with the towels and things to use. But after Grandpa died, well, when the children moved in, Grandma, and it was never the same after that, because the modern thing commenced to come along, better roads is built, and they have as many comforts over there about it now as we have over here, you know. Everybody, I know my son lives over there, as he lives in one of the houses, but the slaves built, made the bricks and everything for this street in the valley that old Colonel Kincaid built. He lives in one of them. And their house heated electric heat and baseboard heating, you know. He's got a bath upstairs and a bath down. And I bet that in this Civil War, troops, when they come through, put up this house. The officers slept upstairs and they put the horses downstairs. And they's hoof marks now on underneath the carpet in his living room floor. And it's on the record at Nashville, and they have their plaque and everything, and no road, they'll never have to give any of that land. He don't own the farm, he just owned about 5 or 6 acres. But they can never take a piece of it. That home's not registered at Nashville. As one of the antebellum mansions, you know, it's got the big pretty white pillars and all. And he got his plaque here not long ago. But that was a great big man. As for the hoof marks, horse kicked the side of the door facing, you know, and they kept the horses tethered downstairs, and they stepped upstairs, officers did. I'd like to hear it talk sometime.
Well, if we had some talking
things
houses,
sure changed, huh?
If we had some talking houses, we'd
yeah.
have a
yeah.
Well, I get the impression from what you say that maybe that your family was sort of an upper class, maybe wealthy
yes,
family.
Yes, grandfather was. I don't know much about my father's people, but coming from Ireland like that, I imagine that they were, well, now my father, he didn't have a high education, but he could work any problem you give him. He could measure a log and tell you how many boards, certain size and thickness could be taken out of that. Or he could fix anything run by gasoline and something. He's just born in him. But now my grandfather's people were always, they liked higher education. They had a nice home. And Grandma was an awful proud woman. She wasn't like the general run of people. She's, in other words, she was a lady. And she wasn't too much of a lady. She could do anything that needed to be done. But she tried to teach her daughters and her children to have the right attitude toward people. That's the main thing I think I could say about my grandpa and grandmother. They wanted a good life for their children. In other words, your attitude towards other people. I think that's the most important thing. Grandpa was a very well-known man. I mean, he was always mixed up in some kind of helping out some cause or something, but he was a born-in-the-wool Baptist.
You mentioned the Baptists before. Are they the
largest
denomination in this area?
I think it's predominant all through the South, really and truly, especially in those days. Now, these times, there's a Church of Christ which we never heard of then. We never heard of the Free Will Baptist Church, never heard of it. I think it was just plain old Baptist. And I had Grandpa's little Baptist, what do you call those little books? Oh, his creed anyway, what was. And Jimmy had it. I gave it to him for his library. It was printed in 1840. Now that's how long that Baptist little, it's the Baptist covenant in all the rules and regulations of the church. You wouldn't even know it's the same church now, the way that it's getting so liberal, you know. But he really did believe in being Baptist.
Well, we'll move on now from your grandparents' day to the building of early Middlesboro. And what do you know about the English that came and settled this area?
Well, I think that if it hadn't been for the cold here, I don't believe they'd ever had a town here. I believe that was really the reason Middlesboro was made. And after the cold, the mines was shut down before the strip mines came. Middlesboro had a pretty hard time of having much income. But since the strip mine's been here, why, it's quite a bit of business for the foundry and for the merchants. And we've got too many. I tell you what I like. I like to see more home-run businesses rather than these big chain stores like the Piggly Wiggly and A&P and Kroger's, these big, off the money, all these towns go somewhere else. I like home-run businesses. I think that's another thing we miss. All these chain stores, chain restaurants, they take too much money out of a community. But of course it makes it nice, but the shipping end of it, we get more things, I guess, we'd get locally.
What caused the English to be here, though? I mean, I understand that Middlesboro was settled by English people, an English company. What were they doing here to begin with?
Well, I guess he came over here for land of new land to invest in things like they did, you know, when they first came to South North Carolina. It was a big law firm from London. I mean, a big land company from London. And they formed a big company here and bought up all this land. Some of it was grants they bought up from the people. And they called it American Association. They owned hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres, thousands, I should say. Well, their holdings are not so big. They've sold off some of it. But they still own the mineral rights to a lot of these strip mines. They have to get permission from, you know. And I don't know who owns the rest of them, but that really, I wish they'd never heard of strip mining. I don't like strip mining. It gives a little income, I reckon, to our town.
Who settled the town? I mean, what, do you have any idea of names of
people? Yeah, Colonel Moffler was the founder of Millsboro. And he was with the American Association, and then some of their folks, you know how it does, then some others came over that's already dead and gone. The old Lean Cemetery out here at East End has got several names. They imported, or emigrated rather, from Poland. They long Polish men came here for coal miners. I was going through the mountains above the old Sterling Mines up Mingo Holler, and honey, I run on to a little graveyard, and they had a bunch of Polish people, and from Czechoslovakia, some of them, they had come to Sterling to work in the mines. They'd been, they'd come in as immigrants, you know, and they had died while they was there and got killed in the mine, different thing. They'd bury them up on that mountain. They just ran on to the graveyard one time when I was walking through the mountains. And of course the stones were very crude. You couldn't hardly read. And some of them just had boards, and the local people had kept the letters plain on some of them. Some of them you couldn't even read. And I found an old man living above Bryson up there in my travels that had slipped into the country illegally. He had, they'd turned him loose in the bay there off the coast of Florida. And they had to give him so much money from to sneak him to our shores. And he wouldn't even rest with us to get food and everything because he's afraid they'd know and ship him back. He's from Austria. and he and his wife lived up the old man Grotz and his wife. And he told me, he said, I don't want to go back. I said, well, they want to ship you back now. He applied for citizenship papers, but the man that he gave the papers to just never did send them off. The man running the coal mine at Reliance, he just never did send them off. So he was still about half hiding up in the mountains. And during the Depression, he just got up against it. And I explained to him that we weren't interested in sending him back to Austria. We just interested in giving him food if he's hungry. And I helped him for a long time on my clients list. So you'll run on to things with different steps of your country way back in the mountains.
Well, tell me about your life as a social worker in the mountains.
Honey, I loved it. It just did my heart good to see those good people that loved their country and they didn't know what everything was all about, some of them. And some of them never had a chance to get out and go anywhere else, one away from the goal. They lived in the mountains and lived in them all their life. And I know that one man lived in this little cabin up there, had a dirt floor in the cabin, and he raised his own hogs, turned them loose in the mountain, and gather them up and kill them when the time come. But, we give them a little bread through the hard time. You see, the people in the mountains lived off the people in the camp below them because they got work from people in the wintertime. They raised a little crop in the summer. They never went to the mines because half of them couldn't have passed the health examination. And when the mines got bad during the Depression, they didn't have anybody to go to. That's the reason they got on starvation because they... And then the American Association got so they wouldn't lease some land hardy, you see, and they just couldn't raise a little corn crop or not.
Pardon me, I'm going to put another tape in.
This is tape two of an interview with Mrs. Pauline Welch by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the home of Mrs. Welch in Middlesboro, Kentucky on June 27, 1978 at 11:30 a.m. Now, Mrs. Welch, before I changed tapes, we were talking about your life as a social worker in the hills here, Appalachia, I suppose you'd call it.
Yeah.
So just go ahead.
Well, really, it was that relief agency that I first started work for, TERA, Tennessee Relief Agency. But I had the territory that I lived in, which was next to the Kentucky side, intermingled. And really, if it hadn't been put in when it was, the people would have been, they would have commenced to pillage towns and all, because when you see your children hungry and there's no way you can feed them, a man becomes more or less violent. And we had to put food and stuff in the mountains because the people didn't have any way to get it. There wasn't any work from them. They didn't have, most of them are getting that free Red Cross flour, but it wasn't distributed fairly. And the Red Cross did a little work, but it wasn't done fairly. And, I think it was just about the only thing that could have happened to the country to keep down the Civil War. Roosevelt was elected and gave the people new confidence, and things commenced to kind of come back, you know, to normal. And I worked under nearly every bit of his administration. He was really president too long because he was a sick man at the last. And he really should have just had two terms, but you can't see things right at the time. We all loved him so good. But
just what years did you work?
I started to work in, I believe it's 1933 and 4. It's when the Tennessee Relief Agency was passed by Congress, you know. And I was one of the first workers out of this. I worked under the Claiborne County, but still took care of part of Kentucky because we so close up there, we didn't know where the line was. So I had families in Kentucky and Tennessee both. And I found without bread, without any means for it. I mean, good people's always been used to making their own way, you know. The mines was shut down. Some of them didn't work the mines anyway. They just got work. The miners hired them to do work. And then they'd make a little crop of their own during the crop season. And they lived a hard life, but still they could make it. Oh, I've been to where, I was on top of Buffalo Mount one time, family was there preserving onions. And I said, never heard of people canning onions. They said, yes, we make a strong brine and peel them and put them in down the brine, seal them up in a jar. Said, we have something to eat with our shucked beans and our dried food in the wintertime. And they just had to do any way they could. So many of them was sick with pellagra because they lived on this cornmeal and hog meat, you know, for so long. And they stank that out now, you see. And I'd carry in my briefcase, I'd carry two extra packages of that medicine for it because it wasn't anything they could get locally. And the government furnished that medicine, it cured that pellagra. And I've carried many a package of it in my briefcase, you know, and families for the woman to have, that's kind of something in their stomach, you know. And they've stanked that out. We don't have that anymore because people don't live on whole fat and cornbread like they used to in the mountains. And I don't know, I love people because they appreciated what the government was doing for them. Most of them did, and very few of them would misrepresent what they had or anything when we'd interview them, you know. They'd be a man much followed, kind of knock his neighbor and all. But most of the time they were good to each other. And I'd have a place in the community. Now, I worked over at one of the big mining communities across next to the Kentucky line over in the other end of the county near Eagan, Tennessee. And one of the men there that owned a lot of new houses, he built one of mine, give me an empty new house to meet my clients in. And in wintertime, it'd be bitter cold. They'd walk for miles in the snow to get there to meet me that day, you see, for that's all the bread they had. And we had one man didn't even have a place to live. The cyclone blowed his house down. I'd give him all together and ask him, he owned an acre of land on top of one of the mountains. He'd aired it. And told him, since the government was giving their living for nothing, to get together and put that man up a little log cabin. They had it built next time I went back. They'd help each other. And now most of the men's able, and the families are in better shape, you know. And I've kept up with some of the families, and they've sent their children to school, and they're living a better life than they used to live. Of course, there's still people back in the mountains. It has to be, somebody has to look after Connie, you know.
Well, now, why do these mountain people have to be looked after?
Why
do they have to be looked after?
Well, what I mean, they depend on another man for some of their extra work they get during the year to buy shoes in the fall for the children that went barefoot in the summer. You see, when that hard physical examination came up for safety's sake in the mines, their bodies are just not strong enough to pass that every time. And then they won't take you unless you're an experienced miner, because you might get killed. So they just can't work in the mine, some of them can't. Get that, Pat.
Did you ever run across any people that were too proud to take a
handout
from the government?
A lot of them done about rather than ask for help. And they did. They'd come shame. I was asked to help one family over in the coal fields. He'd always been a big lumber man, you know. And he was kidding some of the wealthiest people in Middlesbrough. They didn't want them to know it. And they asked me if I'd care to come after dark some night there if I was over there. They didn't want their neighbors to know. They'd ask for help. They said they just didn't have enough to make it. And I went after dark and took their order, and I preserved their pride because I admired them for that. And I didn't give them any more. I just give them what they'd give if they'd come to the office. But I like to see people proud. I think it does something to a man to have to ask for help. And if he was too proud, why, and he was sick too, I thought, well, that'd be a good excuse, he's sick. And I never did tell anybody that I was helping them too, because it wasn't anybody's business. Yeah, you found people too proud to ask for help. And you found some you couldn't give them enough, you know.
Well, what did you give the people? You mentioned bread. What other food
Honey,
did they get?
Honey, they sent in, now that's another thing, whoever's in charge, that sure was weird. We got in so many grapefruit and Claiborne County that people never seen any before back in the ridges and all. went there at one school where I took them a lot of stuff for their hot lunch, a lot of great food, which we know and like to eat. And I went back, and this woman said, "Miss Welch, I don't know what my children won't eat that." I said, "Well, did you fix it like I told you?" "Well," I said, "it didn't have enough sugar. It's the salad, they couldn't eat it." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. You get the juice, take the juice from it, and that won't take as much sugar as if you sweeten the whole thing." One woman boiled it and boiled it and boiled it, and of course it wasn't fit to eat, nor she done that. They just didn't know how to fix it, even after you tell them. This woman took the pith out and put the layers of the juicy things in her crock, down in her spring, layers of sugar laying out. And the school children just loved it like that, you know. But we get loads. I forget how many barrels of meat from Cudahy Packing Company at St. Louis. Well, I was giving it out right and left from my home. The people met on Friday morning, and I got to have it brought from Tazewell to the county truck. And the phone rang next door. We had one telephone that came. They called me and said, "I was wanting on the phone." The administrator of Tazewell told me they'd found out that car of meat, the refrigeration had failed on. It'd sell on the railroad trucks for days and days, and part of the meat was spoiled, and not to give it out, it'd make somebody sick. Well, they had to call back in what I'd given out and had to burn it. They gave me a written order to burn it because they didn't want nobody to get poisoned on it, see. Well, then they started to talk that I had good meat, wouldn't let nobody have it, and I was burning it up. The people, ignorance, you know, they didn't understand it. And then they came in. I know I ate supper one night. We got out of butter. I hadn't been in town to get my groceries. I had 800 pounds in my dining room. We wouldn't eat a bite of it, so if I ever had to swear out, I had it. And I said, "There I was, 800 pounds of butter in my dining room. Was out of butter for my table." But that was mismanagement. I should have gotten up on Friday to have done. But, oh, honey, we go down to the store at Fork Ridge, I would, and I'd give out the food orders. And they was pretty honest with the people this coal company was. And one man said, "Miss Welch, where do you keep all these molasses you're giving out?" I said, "Oh, I'll pay in my house in them." And he said, "I've never seen any molasses in my life. These people got that you give out." I said, "They're glad to get it. They haven't had any sweet stuff." But it's commodities, they called it. And we'd send tabs from the county trucks to bring each community that we gave out. That's how they distributed it. And then I'd carry a load of stuff. I know one time so many of the little children was sick, and I had to carry the stuff with me. I took my car and took a load, so we'd tie them over till I could get it brought over to the distributing points, you know. I did everything I could to keep the people that was sick and needing things bad. If I had to take it with me in my car, I took it, because there was a lot of want. People might make fun of those days, but I don't want to be done if the government hadn't done it.
Well, clothes sent in to the people?
Huh?
Clothes, you know, clothing, shoes, and this type of thing. Did
well,
they
now,
in?
They didn't give out many clothing things. They just couldn't fit them and carry all the size. They had no way of handling them. So we would be allowed a food order to a family for a very little amount, about once a month. I know they, most of it was used for shoes, especially in the winter, and I just never did get enough to go around to buying all the shoes I need for my people. They just barely enough to keep them going, is all they gave out. The government wasn't extracting that part of it. But, well, I had some terrible experiences then. I'd gather up stuff in Middlesbrough and take to them when I didn't have an order for them.
Did you have any?
I bought a many pair of shoes out of my salary check, because I just couldn't stand to see women as sick, their feet barefooted, you know. It was awful days. People lived here in town, had a hard time. But they didn't know anything how the people living out around in the urban, you know, the rural communities, I mean. They just didn't know anything about it. I know I was telling about an experience I had with a man over there. He met me at Tazewell, and there was snow and ice all over the ground. He'd walked 9 miles from Lone Mountain to Tazewell. And he said, "Miss Welch, I'm up against it." He said, "I'm ready to quit." He said, "Baby's got pneumonia and they won't credit me at the drugstore for the medicine." Said, "Went out to the Gap to milk and the cow dead, she froze to death last night off cold." Said, "Don't have anything in the house." I said, "Well, how'd you get in town?" Said, "I walked." He had his overalls on, there's a hole here, and he didn't have on any underwear, just that pair of overalls, no socks, just his shoes. He was a good man, but he had one club foot. And so I tried to give him a job. They wouldn't have him on road work on account he's crippled. And I went with him to the drugstore and stood for his medicine. Told Doc Rays I'd pay him for it. Got him some orange juice thing to take back with him. I said, "Now, Fred, I've helped you every bit the government will let me. Give you money out of my own pocket." I said, "There's something wrong. I've tried to get you on the commodity truck. I've tried to get you help. Can't get you on the road." I said, "What kind of life were you living? Haven't you ever been a man who could talk his troubles over with the Lord?" He said, "I used to be a good Christian, but I haven't been one in a long time." I said, "You promise me you go home tonight, you get on your knees somewhere and ask the Lord to help you. I've done all I can do for you. And I'm just going to help you every bit I can." But I said, "Now, we got to have help. There's something wrong somewhere." Well, one only just a day or two order come through that we had to have somebody to help on the commodity truck. And oh, he was a strong man, even with that crippled foot, you know, he's rolling. But I said, "Now, Fred, you get you a good warm coat on a credit till you can get a payday." Of course, they just paid about $28, $9 a month, I don't know, whatever. He was tickled to death, and the woman in charge of it was Judge Davis's wife, and she had tried and tried to get him the job. And the last I heard of him, he bought it. He owned his little place now, and was getting along all right, you know. But people like that just couldn't help themselves, and when the farmers got right hard up, they would get rid of their tenants, you see. They couldn't harm because they had no money to pay them with, and that throwed another class of people out of work. We all depend on each other more or less to live, you know. And I could tell you time after time where the real good people never knew what it was to need help, had to have it during that Great Depression. And most of them today own their home, get mom fine. Of course, everything they got's going for taxes, so not much difference. But it was a wonderful experience. I feel like it helped me more than I helped anybody, because I enjoyed meeting the people, Good Mountain people. They'd cry for me, the children was, when they get out of milk, they say, they call me the milk woman, you know, I bring them that powdered milk. And some of the little children have summer complaints, you know, and they didn't have anything to feed them. Oh, I don't like to think about it.
Have anybody starve to death?
They'd send us workers from other counties, didn't know a thing about the mine company and our problems and all, you know. And some man came from Nashville and said, "I don't see as a miner, if a man works a coal mine, why he needs any help." I said, "Well, I've got his statement from the office, read it." He read it, and the man who'd only worked enough of days, he was still about $4 or $5 short of paying his cuts for that month, you know. Couldn't draw a cent because his cuts owed in the office. He said he didn't realize that. I said, "Because you don't know anything about the mines. That's the reason you don't know what problems they have." But they'd send us workers in here from Nashville who didn't know anything about the problems of our counties or anything. I don't know.
Well, what other programs did the government have here in the mountains? Did they have like the WPA or the PWA?
Well, they had that put up road projects. They did a lot of good things. I know two or three roads that they built. And that CC program they had, that was fine for the young boys that couldn't get work. I had several of them that went, that I'd sent CC camp, went right out at that into the military service, you know. And it was a good thing for the boys. They've got that project kind of like now down below Middlesbrough, you know, that forestry thing. It's more or less kind of like CC tapes.
Do you have any people doing any feuds?
Huh?
Do you know of any feuds of mountain people? Do they still feud? Did they feud then?
Feuds,
uh-huh.
No. They feud worse in town than they do in the mountains. They're feuding in Middlesbrough if anybody tells you. No, I don't know. They've been married a lot and all. They don't have any trouble with each other anymore. But I can remember back when they'd shoot at each other behind the bushes. But now they don't have that anymore.
Well, what did they used to feud about? I mean,
well, I just like greed, I guess, one thing, and then sometimes one of their children would do something to the other side, you know, and then they'd get some little, sometimes one of the things, except just imaginary, you know, and be jealous of that. They don't have that anymore in the mountains. Not around here they don't. Most mountain people get along pretty good.
Well, what type of education? You said that they didn't, the parents, like, didn't have an education, but some of the children are now. Where do mountain children go to school?
Well, now, some of them goes to LMU, some of them goes to Berea, some of them would go and come over here and take a business course in Middlesbrough. But most of them that was able would come over here and finish high school. And a lot of them went on to UK and all, you know, where their parents was able to send them. We had an awful lot of young people at Bondi got good education. But long years ago when you was talking about it, miners just didn't educate their children one time much. Now my kids helped themselves. And Charlie was, he was sick 18 years with Parkinson. Patty wouldn't, I wasn't able to send her to college when she graduated high school, and she went to Knoxville and took her. She's a nurse, RN. That's the way she was in the Navy. And she said, Mother, I want to be a professional person. I don't want to just clerk in the store or work in the office. The understaff said, I want to have a profession. So she went in that. Then when the older boy got through, we let him go to UK, and I swear it cost so much, he couldn't stand it. So I sent him to Cumming College, you know where it is, Williamsburg. He went there a while, but after he's married, he went back to University of Georgia. He's administrator of the big new hospital now at Kingsport. And Jimmy, of course, the government paid for his education cost. He got an appointment to the academy on that first class. He'd always wanted to go to Annapolis, and his principal interested him in this new academy they started. And I prayed so hard on him. Sometimes I think it's a mistake to say him because they just about brainwashed that first class. It's hard on him. Oh, mercy. He just almost come back after he went. They just couldn't hardly take it. Now they're more level with him, and they don't make it hard on him. But they's hard on that first class.
Now, this was the first class for the Air Force
again. Yeah. He graduated from that in 59, and they sent him on a tour of Europe for all of the academies over in there, you know, England, Spain, everywhere. Government furnished that. They claimed the education they gave that first class academy was over $50,000 they put into each boy. And he's got a wonderful education. He's got his master's degree, and he's still got some of his other degree. And he loves his country. He likes that military. But he's young.
Let's go back and talk a little more about the mountain people. What was their origin? I mean, what are they they're descendants of what people? Any particular?
Well, now, I think the purest people in the whole United States are the Anglo-Saxon people that's in the mountains here. That's the purest English-speaking people. I believe, I mean, the cleanest, best blood of anybody, the real mountain backbone of the people. They're the first to volunteer if they call for arms, and they don't make any trouble on anybody. And then out of their homes come some of the finest men that we've got anymore. I believe, do believe that. Now, my people have a little Indian blood in them. About everybody lives near North Carolina got some Indian blood. But my father was Irish. But my mother was Scotch-Irish and English. And got, as I say, grandpa. My grandfather had a little Cherokee blood in him. But I guess most of them, it's been in the mountains, mountain Appalachia, I guess most of them do have a little Indian blood, don't you guess?
I imagine.
Well, now, how would you describe the mountains today as compared when you were a social worker?
Oh, honey, they're nothing like it, because they won't even let us water now on the American Association. You see, they made them all move out of the mountains. They don't lease the land out anymore. And you'll find a few people living in the mountains, but not like it was. They usually buy their little piece of land or something. But you don't find as many people living in the mountains like you did when I worked. They live in the mountains, and they come down in the summertime, make them a little bit, and do a little work, get the family shoes for winter. That's just about all they ever did. And they can't do that anymore. It's changed entirely. But there's just not much public work for people back in the mountains. And most of them had to move out of there. See, the old ones have died out, and the young people's come down and been absorbed in the local communities and all. Some of them work in filling stations, some of them work common labor. And as I say, some of them had guts enough to go on to school, make something out of themselves. We don't have too many mountain people like we had a few years ago. Oh, honey, I helped out with the Salvation Army here at that big flood on Pineville. This couple we got here just worked day and night till she just had to go home and go to bed, and asked me to come down and answer the phone for them one time and receive the goods they say into them, you know, as it was brought in. I worked one afternoon down there. I always help them out at Christmas. And the people that come in there had pretty good homes. They got their miner's pension, you know, and they got them a little place, pretty nice, where they could have a little garden. Honey, they lost everything they had. Their refrigerators, their washing machines, their furniture, their house full of mud, had kind of washed away. And a lot of those people now have them start over again. Government sending up trailers from living part of the time. That's no way for anybody to raise a family. So I guess right now the people in Bell County, that class of people is harder up than they've ever been, because they've lost everything they had. A lot of them have.
Now, that you're speaking of the flood, wasn't that last year? And
that was last. That was year before last.
Year before?
No, not wait a minute.
Well, it may have been.
I guess it was a year ago last April when that flood happened, going on its second year. We got an awful. Major Bowers and his wife did an awful good work down there. But there's always some that's got their hand out, you know what I mean? Then there's some that need it, don't want help. So I think it's great change taking place in the last two or three years in the way of life. In fact, ever since I once failed. Just not good taste, you know.
But there has been a great change here in the area.
But there is a big change, I think. And a lot of our people left at that flood. A lot of them went to Michigan to get work from down around Pineville. But just some of them just won't be back in the same places, and you can't blame them. Oh, it was awful. Some of them went back in this room. One man put all of his records and everything up on top of the cabinet. Well, honey, it went clear on up and up on the second floor, a lot of their homes and all, you know. It was awful. They lost their trucks that they made a living with. They lost their cars. You just see them floating down the river after that for days and days.
Has this happened often, these bad floods?
Yeah, most of it's called the strip mine. All that old silt made it so bad, you know. They had flood control down there, but it come over the flood. Said when that water come on that flood wall, just like Niagara Falls. And my, they had a flood tonight. My husband died, but Jimmy came in. He got between the flood wall and the pine wall, couldn't get out till the next afternoon. Just said had to sit in his car there 12 hours. Water went down so they could get to Middlesbrough. It's awful. I wish they'd do something with Pineville.
But Pineville's the place that has the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Than
we have floods here, but we get the people out, take them out in boats, take them to City Hall. So part of our city has flood problems out in my own districts. You know, it's two or three of them. But if we ever have a flood up on top of the mountain here, we'll know something about it here, too. So they put in a lot of our low lots, and we'll just have a lot. I think right here, I don't worry about so much where I am. But now the people lives up and down next and all, they'll have trouble. But you know, you used to barn it, it'll be bad enough when it comes.
Don't worry about it till it gets there, huh? Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add about the days of your grandfather or Middlesbrough itself?
I think I've covered it pretty well. I know that that they would come to Middlesbrough for supplies and things. They didn't get out of Knoxville, I know that. Middlesbrough used to be a boom town, you know. They said, I wish they hadn't tore down the old Boonway Inn. It was a beautiful building. And during the days when in its heyday, there sure was a lot of money coming in and out of Middlesbrough. But that'll never happen no more because the mines have all been worked out.
When was Middlesbrough's heyday? About what years?
I guess during after the 1900s, I guess is when you'd call it, because 1905 was when we left La Follette, I believe it was 1905, 1906. And La Follette was at a low ebb, but any place where they had a lot of coal mines is pretty good business, you know. But we could use a few more industries here now if we had them. All we got shopping centers.
Is coal and strip mine, is that the main industry still here?
Huh?
It's coal and strip mining, is that still the main industry?
Yeah, that's still a big asset to the town, is strip mining. Whether we want it or not, we've got it. They're making them put back part of the way they're doing, but now, Wendell Ford, when he was governor, he wanted the mountains all raised up so they could be used for school. No, well, people can't get up those mountains to go to school. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. Be better to set pine trees out or something, let the growth come back, you know. I guess good thing I'm not in politics.
You get them lined out, wouldn't you?
I'd make some changes, I want you to know. I wouldn't have all that corruption in it.
Thank you, Mrs. Welch, for this interview.